Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI offers words of encouragement and hope to those who are struggling in this time of economic difficulty. We celebrate an historic event that took place 40 years ago today. And film critic Peter Malone takes a look at My Sister's Keeper, a weepy made with intelligence and insight. Pope Benedict XVI says that even in the midst of economic difficulty, strength comes from living gospel values, such as respect for human life and for the family. The Pope's words of encouragement came on Sunday while addressing the crowd gathered to pray the midday Angelus in Romano Canavese, a village close to Lecombe in Aosta Valley, where he's spending some days of rest. Emma McCarthy has this report.
It was the first public outing for the Pope since his arrival at Lecombe in the mountains of Valle d'Aosta for a period of rest. It is also his first public appearance since his accident on Thursday night, during which he fractured his right wrist.
Come vedete, a causa del mio infortunio, sono nella mia attività un po' limitato.
Sporting a plaster cast, a smiling Pope confessed he was somewhat limited before he thanked the doctors of Aosta who treated him with skill and courtesy. Pope Benedict also thanked all those who had sent him prayers and wishes for a speedy recovery. The Holy Father arrived in Romano Canavese by helicopter. The white-yellow colours of Vatican flags hung from the windows of the houses in the village and adorned the small stage set up before the Church of Saints Peter and Solitor, from where he recited the Sunday Angelus prayer. Thousands had come from neighbouring towns and villages to greet him.
Cari amici, non scoraggiatevi.
Dear friends, he told them, do not be discouraged. Providence always helps those who do good and are committed to justice. It helps those who think not only of themselves, but also of those who are worse off. The northern Italian region, once a flourishing centre for technology industries, is now experiencing the difficulties of the global economic crisis. The Holy Father praised the region's long history of respect for the fundamental values of family and human life, attention to social justice, the ability to tackle hard work and sacrifice, the strong bonds with the Christian faith. These same values, he said, will allow the generation of today to build their own future with hope, giving rise to a truly united and fraternal society, imbued with the spirit of the gospel. Then in a message directed to young people, he asked they be proposed examples and models that encourage them to follow the ways of the gospel and of real freedom. Young people are full of resources, he added, but they must be helped to overcome the temptation of the easy and deceptive paths to find the path of true and full life. The Holy Father's next public appointment is Friday for the recitation of Vespers in the Cathedral of Aosta, and then Sunday for the Angelus, which will be recited in Lecombe. I'm Emma McCarthy.
Thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report. Today, Monday the 20th of July 2009, is the 40th anniversary of a very special event. An historic event that resonated the world over, whilst billions of people watched on television or listen to the radio with bated breath and much anticipation, including the Pope of the time. Veronica Scaresbrick tells us more.
It was the 20th of July 1969 when Pope Paul VI sent a radio message hurtling through space across a 250,000-mile void to the men who had just fulfilled an ancient human dream, that of walking on the moon.
Pope Paul VI is speaking to you, astronauts. Honor, greetings and blessing to you, conquerors of the moon.
For Pope Paul VI, the moonwalk was a recognition of the greatness of God's handiwork. The moon itself, he personified poetically as the pale lamp of our nights.
Pale lamp of our nights and our dreams, bring to her with your living presence, the voice of the Spirit.
As the tiny lunar module neared the surface of the moon, scouring the landscape for a safe stretch to touch down on, all over the world, people scoured the fuzzy images from space on their television screens, anxious to see what would happen. Pope Paul was no exception. He too watched the landing from his summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, which houses the Vatican Observatory. And as Neil Armstrong stepped down on the powdery surface of the moon, Pope Paul VI clapped his hands and said,
"We are close to you with our good wishes and with our prayers, together with the whole Catholic Church."
Often caught peering at lunar landscapes through the telescope at the Vatican Observatory, Paul VI had always shown a special interest in space travel. In the very first speech of his pontificate, he said that with the blessing of God, it had opened up a new era for humanity. And on a later occasion, he had given an astronaut a specially engraved bronze plaque to be laid on the surface of the moon with the words from a psalm, "O Lord our God, how great your name throughout the earth." In return, he got a piece of the moon, which today is still kept at Castel Gandolfo.
I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
And the relationship between the Vatican and astronomers goes a long way back in time. Vatican astronomer, Jesuit brother Guy Consolmagno traces the history of the Vatican Observatory, one of the oldest astronomical research institutions in the world.
Well, the Vatican Observatory likes to trace itself back to the reform of the calendar in 1582. In some ways, we're even older than that, because astronomy was one of the subjects that they taught in the medieval universities. But more specifically, as a current institute of the Vatican City-State, we date from 1891. And our first position was in the Tower of the Winds and on the walls of the Vatican itself. Then in the 1930s, we moved out to Castel Gandolfo and put some telescopes on the roof of the Pope's summer home and had some offices in the summer palace. Then in the 1980s, we built a new telescope in southern Arizona and some of our staff moved out there. This year, in order to have more room for the observatory and more freedom to be able to do what we need to do during the summer months when the Pope is also trying to use the summer palace for his work, we've separated ourselves and moved the quarters of the Jesuits and the staff offices to a completely refurbished convent in the Papal Gardens. We still have access to the telescopes that are on top of the roof, though, and we can still use them both for scientific purposes and for educational purposes.
As Brother Guy was mentioning, the observatory has just recently moved. And really, the astronomers can almost be described as camping in the Pope's summer garden.
Oh, and it's a wonderful camp out. The building has been completely rebuilt from the inside, wired for the internet age, wonderful electrical outlets. Now they're all the same kind of outlets, unlike a building that had been sort of built on over 50, 75 years, in fact. And I'm delighted I have a new air-conditioned lab where I can work on my meteorite collection. We've got our library now all in one place, where before it was scattered over various floors of the Papal Palace.
And although Brother Guy plays it down a little, a very rich library that is indeed.
Well, we don't have any really valuable first editions, just second editions. We've got a second edition of Newton's Principia, and a third edition of Copernicus's De Revolutionis, the book about how the planets go around the sun. We've also got collections of scientific journals going back to the 17th century, a complete run of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London, for instance, with papers by Isaac Newton in them.
Brother Guy is also in charge of the Vatican Observatory's unique meteorite collection.
It's wonderful. I joke with my fellow astronomers that they think they're studying stars and planets, but all they really get to study are light from stars and planets, the things they can collect with their telescopes. But me, I've got actual pieces of outer space that have come from the asteroid belt, or in a couple of cases, pieces that have been chipped off of the moon and even off of planet Mars. And I can bring these into the lab and poke them and prod them and find out how they've been put together and what things they've seen in the 4.5 billion years that they've been floating around the solar system.
Pieces that have been shipped off the moon. That takes us straight back to where we started, the moon landing on the 20th of July, 1969.
I'm going to step off the laminate. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I was in high school when that happened, so it does make me feel a little ancient now.
Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon.
It was midnight in Michigan, and I remember watching the television set and recording it on a little tape recorder so that I, for a long time, had the entire sequence memorized, drifting to the right a little bit, and, the light coming on and just...
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the lunar.
Are you getting a TV picture now, Houston?
Neil, yes, we are getting a TV picture. You're in our field of view now.
I'd like to evaluate the various paces that a person can traveling on the surface. You do have to be... rather careful to keep track of where your center of mass is. Sometimes it takes about two or three paces to... make sure that you've got your feet underneath you.
I remember it extremely well, and especially associated with this place.
Jesuit Father Christopher Corbelli oversees the Vatican Observatory's research group in Tucson, Arizona. But thinking back, he says, he was right here in Rome on that historic date.
Because 1969 in the summer was my first visit to the Specula Vaticana, or the Vatican Observatory, and during the month that I was here, so the moon landing took place. So it was wonderful excitement. I remember very distinctly Pope Paul VI giving a broadcast in the dome of the Schmidt telescope about the significance and the wonder of this, humankind's first landing and first setting foot on the moon. And then he came out on the terrace that was in between actually the two domes there to thank the people who had made the broadcast possible, so the technicians and the producers and everything else, and I was out there as well, so joined the line of people being presented to Pope Paul VI, and that was my first meeting with a pope.
Father Corbelli remembers the moonwalk coincided with his first meeting with a pope. To Brother Consul Magno, it also brings back the memories of a time during which the American people had a deep need for positive heroes and hope.
It was the summer between my junior and senior year, and I had become sort of cynical about the world, but that brought me back. It was the time of Vietnam, it was the time of student riots, it was a very unsettled time in many parts of the world. I know that there were terrible things happening in Great Britain and Northern Ireland in that year. And yet, this was something that reminded us that the world was bigger than whatever crisis seemed to be going on the daily news. And indeed, reading history now, we remember Galileo. We remember that Galileo got in trouble with the Pope. Does anybody remember the name of the Pope? We remember Galileo's crisis occurred during the 30 Years' War. Does anybody remember what that war was about, who was fighting it? In the same way, in 1969 in America, the Vietnam War was everything. 100 years from now, no one will remember the Vietnam War, but they'll remember people landing on the moon.
So, the Vatican Observatory is, in Brother Guy's words, camping out in the Pope's summer gardens. But it branches out afar, and who better to tell us more about that than its supervisor in Arizona, Father Christopher Corbelli.
Well, it's called the Vatican Observatory Research Group. It's a place where we can have great access to observing. It's now that the observing in Castel Gandolfo has been diminished considerably by the amount of light that everyone naturally living around is putting up in the sky, it makes our telescopes not so efficient. So to find the efficient telescopes, we go to the good dark skies and deserts of southwestern United States, and that's Arizona. It's a great center of astronomy.
And what exactly, Father Corbally, is your area of expertise?
I study stars, surprisingly, because there are all kinds of other things in the universe to study, and you might study planets or the little guys that our brother Guy Consolmagno studies, the meteorites. I study stars, and particularly through their spectra or their rainbows, because it tells me so much about them and their personalities.
Personalities of stars?
Oh, sure. Now, just with people, you can take a group of people, and if you look at them from a distance, you can sort of say, well, you know, sort out their heights maybe, and you know, their sizes. But then the closer you get, the more you realize that each one's an individual. So there's the same with stars. You can either look at them at, as it were, a certain distance and sort them out into types and categories, or you can look at their details and find out how one stars of a particular type will vary a little bit one from the other, and then you start asking the questions. Why?
And answers, he says, can be very slow in coming. But, he points out, there have been some real changes in our understanding of the universe, and it's difficult to pinpoint a single great achievement that is more important than others.
I can't say there's any one achievement. There have been so many. A delight in these days of the reunion of our former students, now alumni of our summer schools, is the perspective that they have on the what's been happening since the time that our schools first began. So 1986 was the first of the summer schools. There have been quite real changes in our understanding of the universe. Our galaxy was quite a different place. It wasn't totally static, but it didn't have all the incredible encounters that we now know about that has built up the population of stars in our own galaxy. So our picture has been changing, and it's been wonderful through the reviews that these alumni have been giving to realize that.
You may be wondering what Father Corbally is talking about when mentioning the summer school at the Vatican Observatory and the presence of alumni. Brother Consolmagno explains exactly what that is all about.
This is an interesting year for the Vatican Observatory in a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. It's the International Year of Astronomy. It's the 400th anniversary of the year when Galileo first pointed his telescope to the skies and saw what the universe looked like through a telescope. So all over the world, people are doing special astronomical events. In addition, though we normally would have had a summer school this year because we tend to have them every 2 years, this is the year that the Vatican Observatory has moved into new quarters. And we knew we weren't going to be ready in time to host a summer school. So we realized this was the perfect time to bring together alumni from our old schools to have a super summer school. We've done this twice before, so this is our third super summer school. And the theme around which the school has been organized is seeing astronomy as a common ground where the entire world can get together and enjoy the universe together.
That sounds lovely. But what does it mean in practical terms?
Well, part of it is just inspired by the fact that here at the school we have the entire world. Our schools have had students from more than 50 nations attend over the years. The organization of this school is by two women, both named Marina, one from Slovakia, one from Argentina, and they've gathered together people from almost every continent, to talk about how astronomy has affected their culture, how they are interacting as astronomers with their culture, and then how we can carry this further. To recognize astronomy is, you know, well, to put it most simply, we're all in the same universe. We're all under the same sky. We're all made out of the same stardust.
We're all made out of the same stardust. I'm no astronomer, that's for sure, but I can certainly relate to that. What's more, I had never thought of astronomy as a lesson in human equality. But next time I lie down on my back for some stargazing, I'll do it with a new perspective in mind, and remember that astronomy is not just probing black holes or analysing meteorites. It's actually a common ground where the entire world can get together and enjoy the universe together. Actually, Pope Benedict has said that much better than me, as he greeted those marking this 2009 anniversary of Galileo's first telescopic explorations and UNESCO's World Year of Astronomy. On this past winter solstice, Benedict himself pointed out that understanding the laws of nature can stimulate understanding and appreciation of the Lord's works.
If the heavens are telling the glory of God, the laws of nature, which over the course of centuries many men and women of science have enabled us to understand better, are a great incentive to contemplate the works of the Lord with gratitude.
Thanks to Ema McCarthy there for conducting those interviews with Brother Guy Consolmagno and with Father Christopher Corbelli. It's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he tells us about a film that I would describe as a tearjerker, but he argues is made with intelligence and insight.
My Sister's Keeper.
So real weepy.
Well, I don't know. I had a great difficulty with the rather, how shall I put it, seemingly insensitive reactions of the London critics. They somehow or other can't respond favourably to films which wear their hearts on their sleeve.
And what is your view of it?
It's an American film, and Americans wear their hearts on their sleeves, and if we are to be culturally respectful to one another, then I accept that. I mightn't like a lot of the sentiment, but I think that it seems to me silly to say that it's, say, a film like My Sister's Keeper is too emotional. I notice that most of the top-class American reviewers didn't think it was emotional, didn't think it was manipulative.
Well, that's obviously a cultural issue then.
But it is, yes. Let's
start by telling listeners what it's about.
Well, I didn't know anything about it before I went in, so it was a bit of a shock, especially when the young actress Abigail Breslin, who's a very good young actress, started to tell us that she was actually the product of in vitro fertilisation to be a help for her older sister.
Most babies are accidents. Not me. I was engineered. Born to save my sister's life.
So that was a bit of a jolt, you know, just right from the beginning. And as the film went on, it raised all the issues about families helping one another with health, but also the identity and place and love in the family for the little child who was conceived for the purpose of helping her older sister.
Who is dying of cancer.
Who is dying of cancer, right. Yes, she's about 14.
My sister has been in renal failure for months now.
You're supposed to give her a kidney?
I want to see my parents for the rights to my own body.
Would you repeat that, please?
What's going on? Anna, you're suing us?
I don't want to do it anymore, Mom. It's my body. I want to be able to make my own decisions about what to do with it.
And it stresses that at one stage the lawyer asks Cameron Diaz, who plays her mother, how long has she been available? And Cameron Diaz actually says, since she was born.
From the moment we decided to genetically conceive, I suppose it was our fault.
But it's against her will, so how does that work?
We went against nature, but we forced her into helping her sister.
So she's been in hospital, she's had all kinds of surgery, and how she sees herself then as loving her sister, she certainly wants to help her, but then wondering about her own life and what it'll mean when the sister eventually dies. So the gist of the film early in the piece is that she goes to a lawyer and asks for some kind of medical independence from her parents.
Which seems to be a very legitimate desire.
It is, and the lawyer makes interesting case for it. He's played by Alec Baldwin, and there are some rather strong confrontation scenes between Alec Baldwin and Cameron Diaz, who plays a very serious role and is absolutely relentless in wanting to help the ill daughter, and seems unable to see beyond that.
What is she doing out of the hospital?
We're going to the beach.
You take her to the beach, you're killing her. Like, she's going to die.
You better come, because if you don't, I want a divorce.
In her head, I suppose she can, and she trained as a lawyer before she had the family, so the character has that kind of mentality. But her treatment of the daughter and talking about the issues, and especially confronting her in the court, it's very strong stuff. And yes, maybe it's tearful, but I thought there was a lot behind the tears.
I don't mind my disease killing me, but it's killing my family too.
One thing I did notice, something that most of the critics who didn't like the film, as you said at the beginning, were saying, was that the acting is in fact fantastic in this film.
Yes, I was impressed by Cameron Diaz. She's obviously older than she used to be when she was with Jim Carrey in The Mask, and she gives a lot to the performance, and it's, I suppose for most people, you can understand her love for her daughter, but she just seems so relentless that she is alienating. And her husband, played by Jason Patrick, is rather low-key. He's much more sympathetic. He supports his wife, but he certainly is open to listening to the daughters. And there's an older son who's also been neglected, and there's a flashback that he had dyslexia when he was young and was sent away for a year to a camp. So he becomes crucial towards the end of the film when they're all in the court.
But what is the message at the end of the film?
But somehow, the very things that tore us apart...
Abby doesn't want to do it anymore.
I don't believe you. You are hiding something, Anna.
Just tell him.
...would bring us together in ways we could have never imagined.
The message, I think, is that you have to allow people to die when the time is right and not be so controlling. I suppose it's that aspect of the church's constant teaching that you can't use absolutely extraordinary means just to keep people alive when, in fact, the whole system is failing and people are dying. And it means then that the young girl will have a life of her own. Some people criticise the ending because it is a bit American neat, in which we see everybody involved and they are certainly starting a newer and happier life, except for the girl who's gone to heaven.
That was Peter Malone, head of the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.